Welcome to Women on Air, a weekly show about women, feminism, and social justice, brought to you by CFUV's Women's Radio Collective.
You are listening to CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. We also stream online at cfuv.uvic.ca. And this is Women on Air, and I'm Jen, your host for today. So I have a couple interviews for you today. One is a piece by Bola Azadi, and they are talking about queer histories and gender assumptions, as well as internal and external imperialism. And then I also have an interview from a while ago done with Jada Kelly when she was in town, so that'll be in the second half. But we're going to just jump right into our first interview, and I hope that you guys enjoy.
Hello and welcome to Bolo Azadi, which means Speak Freedom in Urdu, a show that happens monthly featuring the work and voices of queer and trans people of color, Indigenous people, and their words. We are coming to you from Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish territories, and I'm thrilled today to have a wonderful guest with us. And that guest is Lee, who's going to say just a little bit about themselves and I think go right into a piece, correct?
Yes.
Okay, go for it. Tell us maybe your full name and any other brief stuff you want to share.
Great. Hi.
Hi.
My name is Lee, Lee Williams Budakian. I've recently started reintegrating Budakian into my name. My name is a constantly evolving and shifting playground, it seems. So the first piece I'm going to share is, it's called Imperialist New. To be new. To be waking up anew, as though for the first time. Z, waking up from a difficult sleep, a heavy, empty sleep, as though the place Z was coming from was no place, was a void, was devoid of space or ground or earth. It was a place to float. And suddenly, green. From side to side, horizon wide, up and down, from inside the ground, from toe to head, green and green from brown. Brown. The color of the sun kissing mixed up skin, kissing through the pale coat Z wears through winter months, the privilege of a pale coat, the way it divides mother from child, privileging the patriarch, the preferred father, drunken white, ever absent, always longed for, always preferable to perceptions of angry, cold, shut down, brown. You ungrateful little bitch, snapped brown mama and slammed the bedroom door, leaving little Z to stare blankly into white palms. Remembering the sun as the rains pour down, washing brown down, Z wants to be a diver, to jump into the pool of glistening brown. Z remembers the sunny breeze. Sitting green on the grass as white in blue shorts came to meet here. Wow, you get so dark in the summer. White in blue with eyebrows raised and pink lips turned into cheek corners. Like person of color dark. His surprise made here nose tickle, more like itch, the way Z itches for summer sun as the winter days have come, the night that only breaks for a few hours of gray. I am a person of color. Oh, really? He pauses. Are Armenians really POC? Well, we're also Lebanese. Really? Nights of raindrops on windowsills, windows next to beds, beds where sleeping bodies rest, sleeping bodies hibernating. To be new. To be waking up anew, as though for the first time, Z waking from a difficult sleep. To be waking up as the rains have come, washing away brown. To be waking up bleached in a bed of white sheets. To be waking up green, unlearning white in the loss of brown. We are not Middle Eastern, she snapped. Well, what are we then, Mom? Z asked. Are we West Asian? We are Armenian and Lebanese. That's just where I was born and raised. And Syrian. That's where Dede's side of the family is from. Why is our skin brown? We aren't brown. Well, what are we then, Mom? Z remembers brown mama stories. Black, black, Bodak, kids called after them. Stop it, Brown Mama shouted at the bullies who beat her brother, Brown Uncle, and turned him blue. Brown Mama painted her black eyes green and brown lips pink. She painted them with thick, sticky paint, painting eyes and lips shut because pretty girls see and speak no evil. But silent stories get passed down. Tearing open seals, Z rips skin off flesh, exposing the red beneath the green grass dripping red from the silenced past. I don't believe I live on native land, the student proclaimed, wearing orange pants, and I don't like the implication that I'm a visitor here. I was born here. The student batted long blonde lashes at blonde administrators, who turned to the rest of us and said, "These are sensitive issues, ladies." Z, green from head to toe, oozing red, fire red, blood red eyes boiling to the rim with blood red tears. Z, sometimes she, sometimes me, but no part lady, thinks back through empty sleep, as though empty were real, as though floating were possible without invisible strings being held down by black, brown, yellow, and red, as though empty was not built on visible backs, held in place by visible hands and shoulders, as though invisible is not a color. To be new. To be new, to be waking up anew as though for the first time. Z, we, waking from a difficult sleep, a heavy, empty sleep. As though the place Z was coming from was no place, was a void. Except that place is someplace. That place is here.
Incredibly powerful, resonant, complex, intense, and beautiful. Beautiful piece, and your performance was just so alive, which is something I know I struggle with when I'm on radio. So thank you so much. What an honor to have you on the show and to have you share that.
Thanks.
So before we get into the piece a little bit, I wanted to just ask if you wanted to share anything else about yourself and maybe a little bit about more about, you know, whether it's yourself as a writer or your life or anything else to go into a bit of a deeper introduction for our listeners.
Sure. So again, my name is Lee, and I'm a writer, interdisciplinary artist, facilitator, arts administrator, and
you have a very cute toque.
And I have a very cute toque. Thanks, Amal. I think I'm most involved right now with thinking through the importance of storytelling as part of collective and personal healing, empowerment, and how storytelling can be part of our movements towards transformative change and justice. A lot of my work and practice deals with radical mental health addictions, utilizing arts as a means for both survival and recovery. Thinking through a lot of intergenerational trauma, again, addictions, mental health diversities. And I also do a lot of work around queer and POC identities and creating and holding safer spaces for QPOCs to share our stories. And thinking through a lot around connecting through our shared stories and growing solidarity with one another.
And what I appreciate so much about you is that you do all of this with incredible generosity and vulnerability and a willingness to share resources and just really deeply come from a place of love and building community. So
thanks, Amma.
Yeah, thank you. And on that note, so coming back to the piece that you just shared, which was called Imperialist New.
Yeah.
And maybe talking a little bit about the title and also all of the different things. I mean, I jotted some notes. There was so much coming up. Some of the lines that stuck out for me, you talked about the night that only breaks for a few hours of day. I mean, there's so much poetry and there's intensity and love and so much feeling, you know, conversations that I felt were happening around colonialism and land and passing and not passing, ancestry, about what a person of color is and assumptions about gender. Mm-hmm. The line about sometimes thee, sometimes me, but no part a lady. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where to really begin, but I guess maybe if you want to talk, I'll start with the title and we...
Sure.
I know we're talking earlier a little bit, you know, off air about the concept of homeland and conquest too. So,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there are kind of no clear-cut answers. And I think the piece is really dealing with the lack of clear-cut answers. The title itself, Imperialist New, it came from the first draft of the writing, to be new, to be new, to be waking up anew, to be imperialist new. And it just struck me immediately. And I guess, yeah, it's dealing with all of these things, right? Conquest, unequal human and territorial relationships, empire, dominance, control of one state or one peoples over another, the exterminations of peoples, how that is then transplanted from one land to another, implications of settler colonialism. I mean, it continues, right? And inside of all of that is also the experiences of identity, right? Within our families, within our bodies, within our genders. There are so many boxes that are put around us, and yet we don't live in boxed existences, right? And so how also to contend with these false dichotomies, POC and white, you know, Armenian, Lebanese, like
seasonally POC, right? You talk about the summer versus winter and perceptions. Right?
And perceptions of passing, mm-hmm. right? And how passing plays out as privilege and also plays out very differently inside the family, right? Systemically walking around in the winter with a lighter coat affords me access. Inside my family, it looks very different, right? So it's playing with the tension between these false dichotomies and trying to find a narrative and a landscape for storytelling that can move as opposed to be fixed and rigid inside these labels and terms. And I don't know if any of that was coherent, but
that was very coherent, actually very coherent. And I think it kind of spoke to what we've talked about many times, you and I, about that we're very complex,
right?
We're multidimensional, and this idea that we're not in just one box, and it's a spiral of different boxes that keeps circling.
Yeah.
And this idea to me about your poem in terms of the, you know, the title really standing out for me about imperialists new, these imperialisms that keep regenerating inside of us internally,
absolutely.
The idea of internalized imperialism, but also externally in our families and in terms of the ways in which we're perceived within a white supremacist structure.
Absolutely.
And I think that your work is so lyrical and beautifully covers that without having to hit somebody over the head with it. It's just there and it's digging deeper.
And I'm really curious about how to talk about, you know, internalized racism and this whitewashing that happens, particularly in a multiracial family where whiteness is part of that family, as well as this like white supremacist landscape. How do we talk about these things without doing it for a white audience or white ears or through a white lens? And yet it's part of it, right? Like, I don't know. So again, I don't have easy answers for it, but
I'm nodding furiously because it resonates and resonates absolutely with my own family and being mixed and what it means in terms of even reclaiming whiteness and doing that in a way that doesn't reinforce whiteness.
Right.
Which is why I'm so glad that you're here with us and sharing that, because to have and carve out spaces where we as cutie POC can have these conversations, especially as mixed cutie POCs.
Totally.
Coming from a variety of mixed experiences, to be able to talk about them, talk about the fact that we are implicated in terms of being on stolen native land. And you reference that in your piece in terms of, you know, this white blonde person who, you know, just assumes that they shouldn't be questioned about this as well, and the people that then reinforce that around them as well, and how Z is being challenged around this and multiple levels, also being challenged as being POC themselves.
Right.
Isn't Armenian even a POC?
Right.
Right. And being questioned about that in your own family. So I wonder if we should go into another piece. And before we do, to introduce it, if you can talk a little bit about this amazingly exciting project that you've been working on for some time called Dear Armin and your trip to Armenia and all the other great things.
Great. Yes. Thank you. So Dear Armin, okay. So September of 2013, last September, I was invited to help create Dear Armin in Yerevan, Armenia. It was my first trip to Armenia. And I was collaborating with Saboteur Productions, and two other amazing artists that are part of that theater company, Cami and Tiffany. And Cami, who is also Lebanese Armenian, we've been wanting to do something that's dealing with queerness and Armenianness and this seeming gap between the two. It's either choose a ethnic identity or choose a queer one. And so Dear Armin was born out of this. And the story centers around this researcher, Garo, who is researching the life of Armin Ohanian. And Armin Ohanian was an enigmatic performer, choreographer, poet, Armenian, who lived turn of last century, so 1800s into 1900s, and completely queers the traditional Armenian woman narrative. She breaks out as a teenager from a marriage, and she becomes this dancer and choreographer and does all these amazing things, and along the way has some queer relationships, and she's just fabulous. So this character Garo is looking for a mentor, and she finds one in Armin. And Armin becomes a foil for the central character to unpack their own gender complexity, their sexuality, and this gap that's happened with their family.
Okay, so why don't we share a piece from that, and you can talk maybe after about where we can find more information and where the show's going to be coming up next, because you're going to be going on this amazing tour.
Okay.
Yeah. Sound good?
Great.
All right.
So importantly, the pieces that I'm going to read, it's a one-person show intertwined with like other performances, and I play multiple characters. And so I'm going to be reading from the characters of Garo, Morkur, and Garine. Firstly, I want to thank you so much for having me here. I don't think I can begin to tell you what it means to me to be here in Yerevan this evening to share with you excerpts from one of Armin Ohanian's memoirs, The Dancer of Shamakha. I have been researching Armin Ohanian for some months now. I'm a researcher and writer interested especially in reviving the stories of women who are not often or not at all represented in literature or history books. I am interested in particular in writing about my ancestors, about the people that came before me who do not have many documents or whose documents have been lost because of displacement, deportation, migration, and genocide. I am interested in how I can write into silence. In my family, silence between women has been the most common sound. The women in my family do not speak of their experiences.
What do you mean the women in our family don't speak of experiences? What kind of things is this to say? Psst! Go upstairs and get your dirty laundry and put it in the washings. Amote! Family is the most important thing in the world. The most important. It must always come first. You know, there are families who they don't never speak to each other. They never call or speak. They are like strangers. I know of one family like this, and that auntie, she is such a sad woman. She sacrificed everything, and now she is alone. Gahavadas. But not this family. This family, we are not like this. This family is the most important families. Ichkiseskoras mapin masin. I know what I'm doing. The mop doesn't clean everything the way I like it. Look at these corners. You think the mop can get in there? Go from here. I just wiped down the floors under your feet. Go take the sheets from your beds and put them in the washings, I said.
Yep. That's what she's like. She compares us with other people and guilts us into not being like them. You've got to love that ethnic guilt, that cultural post-genocidal guilt that gets you just where it counts. But try asking her a question about herself. Try asking her what it was like before. Oh yeah, she'll talk to you about the neighbors, and she'll talk to you about those other families, most of whom she makes up, by the way. But she won't actually talk about this one.
Shh! They might hear you!
No, we bury things. You know, time, stories, bodies, bones. We bury them in our yards and, well, sometimes in our closets. It's a whole thing. Then we disinfect. We begin with the sheets on the bed. It's always the sheets on the bed. They need to be bleached. Preferably washed the first time by bare hands dipped into the corrosive liquid. Kill two with one. Make sure to remove any trace.
Yes, so I think you are talking about my family. And somehow you managed to channel them in there. Or perhaps that's the feeling that all cutie pucks are going to have upon hearing that piece. So much is resonant and familiar there, and so much is also obviously so uniquely about your family. So How did it feel to read it on air? Have you, I mean, I know you've performed it before, but have you shared it on radio before?
No, definitely okay. not. And actually, the performance we did in Yerevan was all in Armenian.
Oh, okay.
And so I'm currently in redrafting, and some of this is new material. I hope my collaborators are okay that I'm sharing this. but yeah, it feels very, I'm nervous and excited.
So it's when you, so let's talk from that about, first of all, where you're going to be performing it next. And what part of that, second part of that question for me then for you is around the language. Is it going to be in completely in English with pieces in Armenian or both? And what was it like also mm-hmm. doing it in Armenian? So maybe starting with where it's going to show.
Okay. So starting May, Dear Armin is headed to New York City and then Toronto and Montreal. For more information on those shows, check out deararmen.com, deararmen.com. What were the next questions?
The next question was, so in the kind of future iterations of the show, will it be then language. Completely in English or right. some Armenian? And
I think there will definitely be integrations of Armenian in it. We will be performing for probably mixed audiences. I'm sure there's going to be some Armenians in the audience. We're planning on specifically performing it in Armenian community centers. There will be English and Armenian integrated and probably heavier on the English side for non-Armenian speaking audiences. And it's a very interesting process right now to, I mean, at one point I spoke and read and wrote fluently, but my experience in Yerevan, it was amazing to see how much has been lost over time. And so the script was originally written in English, and then I worked with a translator to get it into Armenian and then rehearsed and had to like relearn Armenian. And now to kind of undo some of that is such a strange process. I know the script now in Armenian, and now I have to get it into English, and it's just a complete head.
It speaks so much to how language is so much part of our identity too, right? That, I mean, for a lot of white people, they don't quite understand that it's not just another language. This is part of our homelands, who we are. It's part of our blood. And it's part of also being in exile and reclaiming our histories of being in exile, right?
Totally.
And so how that changes the nature. I'm grappling myself with like trying to write in Urdu and putting that into my writing. And so that's why I wanted to ask you what that was like. As a follow-up too, then how was it in terms of being, I guess we haven't talked too much about how it was received in Yerevan and how with the audience being mixed, particularly in terms of the themes around queerness and you being there as mixed, maybe you wouldn't mind talking a little bit about that?
Sure, yeah. The show sold out and it was really warmly received. It was, you know, it's a challenge. I mean, as a diasporic Armenian and as a Lebanese Armenian at that, I don't even have roots that kind of trace back to current day territories called Armenia, right? So I felt very mindful of my identities intersecting with this space that I was visiting. And it's a very complex time politically in Armenia in terms of queer issues, in terms of gender issues. And this play is in particular taking on stuff around queerness and Armenianness. So again, coming back to like earlier comments, I don't entirely have language to depict the and explain kind of the complexity of that, but it was a really soul, I don't know, crunching, changing something experience to be bringing this show and learning alongside folks that, you know, live there. And yeah, I don't know. Train of thought.
That train dot, of thought. Dot, dot. Actually, I think that train of thought has been there since the beginning, because to me, this piece that you just shared from Dear Armin is so connected. I mean, how can it not be to the piece called Imperialist New? And as you're talking, I'm thinking about the ways in which imperialism keeps reinforcing itself, even in terms of language, right. Having to now shift back to English and think about who your audience is going to be and how that will be received with a different audience, and doing it for Armenian community audiences and maybe a mixed audience and what that's going to be like, and hopefully bringing it back to Vancouver at some point so that we can see it and experience it firsthand ourselves. So there's, to me, a lot of resonance in terms of, and a lot of, I think, similar themes, recurring themes that are coming out in what you're saying. And one of the things I want to say about your writing for me too is it's so multidimensional. Like we talked about how complex we are and that we're not one dimensional. But to me, I think you've described your writing, and I'm going to ask you to describe it a little bit. But, you know, I think one of the words you've used at different points is intense. Mm-hmm. There's also a lot of humor and wit. Very well-timed wit, particularly. Was it a grandmother role or that character that you're speaking in a...
Yeah, she's more cool. She's okay. Like a mother's aunt.
Okay.
Or aunt from the mother's side. That's what it actually means.
Well, she's very funny. I mean, yes, she's burying stuff at the same time. She's, you know, the comparison, obviously, to other families, which we can all...
Uh-huh.
That speaks to so many of us as well. So how would you describe your writing?
My writing... intense is definitely a word that gets used to describe it. And I think for me, my writing comes from an intense place. You know, it's, writing as an act of survival, you know, processing. I write from a place of trying to deal, you know, with the living stuff. So it's for me necessarily intense because, intensity is often what I'm feeling as well. I've been writing for almost as long as I can remember. I don't know.
So transitioning from writing, because you're also someone who performs and an actor and a playwright, among many other hats, brilliant hats that you wear, facilitator, educator. And I've been curious about that for some time. What does it feel like in terms of a transition from moving from writing into performing? Because mm-hmm. I know for me that can be a struggle, also dependent on the piece. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm thinking now about, I'm also going to, when I wrap up in a few minutes about asking you about thoughts that you might want to share or advice with Cutie Pock writers. So, but before we come to that, as kind of leading in, do you think there's a transition between writing and performing, and what does that feel like for you?
Yeah. It's interesting. I feel like my relationship with performing is constantly changing. I don't necessarily see myself as an actor, and I see lots of the written work I do as an extension of spoken word, you know, and storytelling as an oral tradition in lots of our families, right, and our cultures. Performing / writing, these things are kind of interchangeable in my experience. But it is challenging in terms of, the spaces where we perform our works and that extension from the page or from a personal space, through to a public space and, what that means to the whole writing thing, you know, performing for an audience, brings up a lot of fears around who that audience is, what space that is, what's safe to say, what isn't safe to say, how will that be taken on? How does that reproduce and reinforce existing narratives? You know, it's a whole thing.
We've experienced some of that together before, I believe.
Yeah.
Yes, for sure. And, I think that is actually one of the reasons we want to have this show, right? Because having those kinds of, no space is safe, but having safer or somewhat safer spaces where we can share that with each other. And even though it goes out in the airwaves and everybody can listen to it, to be able to have a space where even the tech and being behind the mics, all of the questions and sharing with each other is happening in a way that's by and for and about Cutie Pock is critical.
Totally.
So we have just a couple of minutes left. And so to kind of end off with that question, I had kind of mentioned about any advice or thoughts that you wanted to share with Cutie Pock, other Cutie Pocks who are either starting the journey of writing or who want to write or are currently writing, but, you know, may want to hear thoughts from somebody who's been doing it for a while.
I guess the main piece of advice is, it's not so much advice, a reminder, you know, our stories are important. And it's for me, constantly a fighting up against that insecurity of, am I allowed to take up space and am I allowed to share from my own experiences? And there have been, so many friends along the way that have reminded me that our stories are significant and that, that taking that risk to share means reaching out to one another. You know, and that in a place where the dominant stories are so loud and so excluding of our voices, it's not a small gesture to be reached out to, you know, to hear an element of your own experiences reflected back at you from someone who knows from, you know, their shoes and their walk, but who can relate. So to remind ourselves that
it's important to tell our stories and that it's okay for us to take up space and that extending that hand will be really significant for someone else on that journey.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that reaching out is the very air we breathe, right? Being reached out to and reaching out. It's the oxygen that we need. We need it. We need it to survive and to nurture each other. And it's so essential, even if it reaches out to just one person.
Totally. Yeah. And just to quickly add to that, the framework around writing is so often about, is this thing good? Is it good enough? Is it some kind of caliber of excellence? And I really love the framework of reaching out, right? Reaching out in all of our imperfections and in whatever stage of a quote-unquote career we might be in, that actually this is an act of nurturance and an act of connecting. It's not about some measure or standard of excellence that we have to meet before we're capable of reaching out to one another, that actually we're beautiful in all of our imperfection, and that that's the place to reach out from, actually.
So beautifully said. I don't have much more to add except to repeat what you said and to say we are beautiful in all of our imperfections. So including bumping the table in the middle of an interview.
Yeah.
So I want to thank you so much, Lee, for being with us. And thank you for Anushka for doing the tech. And we will hopefully be back with Bolo Azadi next month. Thank you.
Thanks.
So you're listening to Women on Air, and that was an interview done by Bolo Azadi. And I hope that you enjoyed it. So I have some music for you guys to enjoy on this great Thursday. And the first song is by Dana Fox and from her title album, Bliss Avenue.
I got nobody, no place to call. Flat on the-
So you are listening to Women on Air, and you just heard the Dalai Lamas and their song, To Know the Funk. And before that, you heard Dana Fox and her song, Bliss Avenue. So coming up next, we have an interview with Jada Kelly, and it's about her new album, Clover. So enjoy. Okay, so why don't we just start with you introducing yourself.
My name is Jada Kelly, and I am a musician based out of Toronto.
Okay. So can you tell me a little bit about your story and how you got to where you are today?
Well, I've been touring and making records for about 4 years now, and prior to that, I was working in the music industry, which is greatly aided my music, and it's opened some ears. Prior to touring, I had four different jobs in the music industry. I was an intern at a label, a music publicity company, and I was an assistant to a blues singer and an usher at a symphony hall at night. And all of those things really helped me release this new record, Clover.
So how would you describe your music?
Lately, I've been having some trouble pinpointing what our genre is, but my bandmates and I we came up with a new word for it, and we're calling it fire folk. We feel like it's a bit spookier than regular folk music, but it still kind of has the same element of storytelling.
Mm-hmm. So that's so cool. How did you come up with that name?
We were just in the car brainstorming words, and we just knew that the word fiery kept coming up. And we were like, what about fire folk? And we Googled it, and it apparently is a pyrotechnic company in Ireland. So I think we're the first, aside from them, we're the only ones who have coined the term.
Mm. That's very cool. So what's the inspiration for your music?
The inspiration for my music, it really comes from my life experiences. And I wrote this last record mostly while I was touring. And I kind of finished it once I put my suitcases down and I started working with a producer by the name of Stu Crooks, and he really kind of helped me decide what my vision was going to be and what my message was going to be.
So what would you say that your message is?
I guess the message of this record would be, the very meaning of the name of Clover. Clover is a symbol for hope, and it's a symbol of luck. And the message of this record is, my hope to have a full life in music. I just, I know that a lot of songwriters here in Toronto, feel the same way. And we're all trying to create our own unique inroad into the music industry, which is, constantly changing. And I guess that's what the message is just of my own hope to just find my own path and to remain present in music. Here in Canada.
So as you said that you have a new album, Clover, can you tell me a little bit about the writing process and the music production of that album?
Well, I had about 40 songs that were written, and I brought them to the producer, Stu Crooks. And we just worked our way through them, and he gradually collected the ones that had the same general message. And a majority of the songs he was collecting were the newest ones, and they just seemed to be stronger, just in writing and in musicalities.
Mm. So do you ever have writer's or musician block? And if so, what do you do?
I used to get really frustrated by writer's block, but nowadays I just try to view it as part of the writing process. I don't think it's possible, at least for me, to constantly be writing all the time. There needs to be a downtime where I'm just absorbing and experiencing things. And I sing and I write little things every day, but when I'm preparing for a record, I kind of just dedicate a small portion of my year to that. I kind of just collect everything that I've come up with and kind of mold it into something that's listenable.
Yeah, absolutely. So who is your music role model?
There's a few people. There isn't just one person. Vocally, I really look up to Iris DeMent. She's an American songwriter. John Prine, kind of brought her to the limelight. And I just love her voice. It's just this beautiful, unique ache in it. And, she never really tours or performs a lot. So when she does come to town, I'm just in heaven. But other than that, I don't know, there's a lot of current bands nowadays, mostly female songwriters that I look up to, like St. Vincent and Sharon Von Etten. Those artists, I really like their creativity with all of their arrangements, and I really like the darkness in their lyrics.
What is it about the darkness that speaks to you?
I guess the darkness in people's lyrics, it presents an honesty. And the way I live my life and, the people that I hang out with, we all speak very honestly. We don't put a veil over our feelings. I just, I know in a lot of pop music and not all pop music, but I just know that, everything has to be upbeat. Everything has to be, it just seems like it's hidden behind something. And I just like the raw honesty and that those artists kind of portray, and that's sort of what I like to strive for, is just being completely naked, with my lyrics, and just creating arrangements that match and kind of paint the lyrics even further.
You're coming to Victoria, and I was just wondering what your favorite part of touring is, and what do you like most about being on the road?
Out of every place in Canada, I really, really love Victoria. I've had such amazing experiences there. It's so beautiful and it's so sunny every time I visited. But, my favorite part of touring in general is just visiting places in the world that I never, ever would have seen had it not been for, that tiny dingy bar in the middle of Twin Butte, Alberta. It's just, you see these really unique communities when you're doing house concerts and playing smaller venues in smaller towns. And, I've done a lot of great traveling because of music.
Where do you most draw the inspiration for your music?
Well, I wrote this record from kind of a sensitive, period in my life. I was just going through a lot of changes and friends I was playing with and people I was working with on a professional level. And it was a very sad time for me when I was writing this. So I think the instrumentation in here is really just a reflection of the emotions I was feeling at the time. And it was very therapeutic in general to make this record and become stronger through writing about it.
Okay, and last question, what is your favorite fan experience, meeting people who love your music?
Well, when I'm not doing my own touring, and I do sing with a metal band, and so occasionally fans from that metal band will come out to my folk shows, and that has to be my favorite experience of every show. Because, they're just from this completely different realm of moshing. It's a different type of concert, and they always seem like a fish out of water while they're there. But it's just really touching that, they kind of jump ship and try to check out my own stuff.
Great. Thank you so much. And can you just say your website so that if people want to look you up or anything before you come to town, they can?
If you'd like to hear our music, you can go to my website, at www.darthjada.com.
I held your heart like a wandering train. Your love comes and goes like wild west rain. I know it's hard, you've gotta know. Pain teaches your heart to grow. I know it's hard, you've gotta see. It's all I can do.
Just heard a song by Jada Kelly, and it was called Wild West Rain. And right before that, it was an interview with her. So I hope you enjoyed the interview and her music. So yeah, that was a great music. And so I hope you enjoyed today's episode of Women on Air. And I just want to remind all of our listeners that Women on Air is podcasted on cfpv.uvic.ca, and it's under the Women's Collective tab. So if you enjoy the interviews, then definitely go check out the podcast. And also one more thing, the Victoria Fringe Festival is coming up August 21st to 31st. And here at the station, we are big fans of the Fringe Fest. So definitely go check that out. It's going to be a great event. But first, we have a song by Dala, and the song is Drive Through Summer.
Just another drive through summer. Just another drive through summer.
Window painting, no explaining. Drive by staring, we're past caring. Yeah.
Just another drive through summer. Just